All right, what's up? What's up, everybody out there in a homicidal world, fanboys and fangirls alike? Welcome to our very first What's Up Wednesday segment of our podcast. I am your host with our illustrious co-host, Lucius Lumlix. I'm RP Wilson. Lou's got our first guest of the podcast tonight, and I'm going to throw it to him.
All right. Homicidal fans, welcome to the first ever What's Up Wednesday. We're very, very excited to have Alvern Ball on mic. Alvern Ball is a two-time, one-year Glyph Award winner and rising star. He's worked on books such as One Nation and Virgin Wolf. And, you know, as a side, we like to thank our sponsor slash leader, Terrahawk One, for making this happen, because I'm excited to get to do this. Much in with the mission of Comicide, we're trying to bring you a better class of comic analysis. So what we hope to get to do today is not just tell you about Alvern's life, but we want to give him a chance to talk about his work, the worlds he's built, the things he's working on now. Alvern, want to say what's up to the fans and give any words?
In the vein of Martin Lawrence, what's up?
Hey! Dope. Awesome.
Thank you guys for having me.
Oh, we are glad to have you here. It is actually our pleasure to have you here.
Hyped about
it. So this is sweet. Yes, we are. So as Lou said, shout out again to our Terrahawk One, our fearless leader, our visionary, the man that keeps the lights on for this, you know, little podcast that could. But since we've got all the greetings and salutations out the way, let's dive into the whole Q&A discussion part of this What's Up Wednesday segment. And let's actually just, you know, jump off the rip and talk about Virgin Wolf. How do you think about that, guys?
Sounds good to me.
Sweet. So actually, the very first thing that comes to mind with Virgin Wolf, fantastic story and everything like that. But I just wanted to probably get into, say, the business aspect of Virgin Wolf. How do you keep the publishing consistency, you know, of a piece like that?
Oh man, that's a hard one. I would have to say, to keep the consistency, it takes a lot of late nights, staying up and and writing, you know, going over the artwork. But I would say most of all, it takes perseverance. You know, it's an idea that I've started probably 5-6 years ago. That popped into my head, and I've pitched it to a couple publishers, and each time it was more like, oh, we like this, but can you cut it? Can you make it smaller? And I had a vision for this book, and the vision that I had for the book, as you know, the first arc is 8 issues, and everybody kept wanting me to cut it down to 3, and I had a vision of the story, so I had to persevere, and I had to stick to my guns and believe in it, to the point where I just said, okay, I'm going to do 8 issues, and once I got the first issue down, it was like a match had been, you know, like a fire had been sparked, and I just somehow, I reached out to a couple artists I knew, a great colorist that I knew, Adriana De Los Santos, and I was like, look, I need to do this. I have to tell this story. So it took a long time to get those first 8 issues out. I would probably say about 4, almost 5 years, I think. But it was just one of those things where I just kept coming back to it each time and working on it slowly but surely, piece by piece, until I had it all done.
That's really what attracted me to the work, the consistency, or what attracted me to, like, we got to get this guy on mic, because, you know, a lot of any published stuff doesn't get the, I say it doesn't get the keepest audience, because there'll be stuff I'm reading where stuff like Nowhere Man and Ajala, which are like great books, but then, you know, when you're waiting, and it's not even quarterly, when you're waiting longer than half a year and you don't really know when the next one's going to drop, you know, with the rest of your pull list, you sort of fall off the book and check back in maybe a year later. And Virgin Wolf, I was like, you know, I think there was like 2 months pause, but the months that was paused was followed by months with 2 issues.
Yeah. So, oh, totally, dude. I didn't mean to cut you off. Sorry.
Yeah. So I was like, ah, cool, we got a story. I think I'm going to get through these 8 issues in a timely manner. And that is going to help me like the story. And I really like the story. And, you know, even though the first volume told a semi-complete story, I think it did leave a lot of the right inklings to have you ask questions about the world.
Yeah, yeah, and totally. That was by design. Because like I said, once I had the first issue done, I released a couple. I remember I did like a con like the first year, and you know, and went around and pitched it and everything. But I didn't want to release it until I knew I had like at least that first arc done, because I felt like. Like you said, with indie comics, we already have a bad rap of, oh, yeah, the first issue or the second issue was done, and then it's like, where's the next issue? And you don't see that next issue for a few years, you know? And with Virgin Wolf, it was one of those things where I had submitted it to Comixology, and it got accepted, and then the first issue dropped, and then I was like, oh, I probably should do the second, you know, put the second issue up, did the second issue. And then by that time, I just started submitting the issues, but they weren't like getting approved. And so I was like, okay, I'll wait. And I was doing something with Peep Game Comics at first, where I was giving them the issues a month before they would go to Comixology. So that's why there was that whole gap in between when issues were released. But the whole idea was that once I put that first issue out, I was like, okay, I just want to keep hitting the readers with the next issue and the next issue and the next issue, so that they know this is a consistent story, and that when you got to the end of that first arc, there are, you know, questions that are going to leave you unanswered. But most of the questions that you need answered have been answered, so that, you know, this next arc, when it comes, it you know, it's just a follow-up. And you don't have to be able, you know, you don't have to have read the first issue or the second issue to pick up this next arc, you know. So that was my whole thing with Virgin Wolf, is that, I sat on this content for a few years just trying to get it all finished, you know?
Yeah, wow. We recognize and respect that, because I was telling Wilson and the rest of the crew, we had somebody on, I was like, well, let's have Alvern Ball, because he just put out a consistent story over the course of like 8 months, and it was a good story. So, you know, questions I have on Virgin Wolf, you know, get the easy one out of the way. It's like her government name, Virgin. Or is this like a code?
Yeah, I guess you could say that. I guess the big reveal, it's kind of masked in the last chapter. I think in the last, I want to say, 5 or 6 pages, it's revealed who her government name is. And her government name is Virginia. So, and I guess, again, I don't want to give away who she is, but I guess it really doesn't matter at this point. But her government name is Virginia Dare. I'm not sure if you're familiar with who Virginia Dare is in throughout history. But if you're not,
No, that was totally cool, because my next question was going to be, I know they're supposed to be like, I can get from reading the book that they're supposed to be like a high link to actual American history. And I was going to ask if I had missed that cue, or if it was something that was going to come in later volumes. But yeah. I guess you just answered my question.
Yeah, it's totally. It's a line when she's fighting like the major, you know, the wolf at the end. And she goes, I have no mother. And she goes, I have no kid. And she says who she basically comes out in that scene when she's fighting the wolf. She finally says who she really is. That was my thing, is that I didn't want to hit the reader over the head and say, look, this is who this person is. This is who this person is. But I wanted to subtly get that if you had been reading all the stuff that had happened up to this point, then when she finally reveals who she is, you're like, oh, that name sounds familiar, but you might not get it just yet. And that's fine, because the idea, the overall idea of what I'm trying to do with Virgin Wolf is that by the end of this whole massive saga, when it all comes back, everything is revealed. Like all the historical moments that's in this arc and the next arcs that are coming up. Everything like comes full circle. So if you miss something, it's all gonna come full circle, and it's gonna be one of those things where it's like, oh, I didn't see that, or oh, I saw that name but didn't recognize it, and this is why. But then, you know, the history of it comes And you're like, oh, okay, now it makes sense.
Yeah, because, you know, me not knowing that bit of history and knowing there was a link to history, that's why it was my question. Because Virginia Dare almost sounds like it could be made up because it's a state. And then right. Dare is just kind of a badass last name. So I was like, yo, I know there's supposed to be a link here.
Yeah, and yeah, dude, the history of it. I don't know if you want me, I can give you the background or like, you know, the quick version of who she is in throughout history, if you need it or if you want it.
Yeah, you can give us the quick and dirty.
Yeah. So Virginia Dare is considered the first child to be born on American land. And in 1587, I think it is. Yeah. 1585 or 1587, Virginia disappears along with the Roanoke colony. And that's how you get Roanoke, Virginia. So this whole idea of what you're seeing in the first arc is the telling of how that colony, which is the first colony in Illinois, I mean, which is the first colony in America before Jamestown, it just one day disappeared and nobody knows why. And there are theories that the colonists basically integrated with the Native Americans and moved on. But this is a story of what if that didn't happen? What if that whole colony was wiped out by werewolves? And at the end, you find out who is behind all of this, which is the father of all werewolves. And, you know, he's plotting a massive campaign for world domination.
Ooh. Wow.
Yeah, and that's what that last page of the book is, that you find out where the father or who the father of all the werewolves is. And it's like, he's where and he's who, you know?
Yeah, and so in this world that's being, in between question, is the fact that they probably merged with the Native tribe some of the inspiration for giving Virgin a Native American mentor in colonial times.
Yeah, and that's touched on in the book, and it's going to actually be touched on in this next arc that I'm going to write, where you get there's this story in, I think, in issue 6 or 7, where she talks about Hania and him. It's issue 7, where you show where I show the colonists first meeting the Native Americans of the New World, and how they're performing the Waya, this ritual that takes place where the spirit of the wolf inhabits these Native people. Well, and as you see, they're also showing the colonists how this ritual is performed, you know. So you're getting that idea of this is how it all begins. And so you learn later that Hania, his son, like basically betrayed him and showed the outsiders how this ritual was performed. And thus the father or thus the idea of werewolves is born. And so Hania basically becomes responsible because he was the chief of this Native tribe when all of this went down. So he essentially feels responsible for what has occurred in the world. And that's why he's out basically hunting werewolves and teaching or mentoring Virgin how to hunt werewolves. You know? And the whole reasoning, I think, yeah, it's revealed in 7 or 8, was that the reason he's teaching her to be a hunter is because he too is a werewolf, you know? And so his ultimate goal is that once they wipe out all of the disfounded werewolves, that she'll eventually take him out also.
All right. Yeah, that's pretty dope. And I gotta say, within this world, it's just crazy. And the way that you build the world off of, you know, a nugget of actual American history, it is wonderful to me. And I wanted to get a chance for you to speak a little bit more on that, on just how you caught this idea of, you know, building such an amazing, brand new, intricate world off of, you know, this very, you know, I'll say esoteric part of our American history. Not many people would know about our Virginia Dare and the Roanoke colony.
Yeah, and the idea, it's weird how it came. Ideas coming to me at the most weirdest moments. And how Virgin Wolf came to me was that I was walking down the street and I heard Virginia Wolf. Like I was reading a sign and something said Virginia Wolf. And in that second, I heard Virgin Wolf. And I love history. So I knew about the Roanoke Colony. And when I heard the words virgin and wolf, it just, like, everything just kind of made sense. It just, like, came to me. I was like, oh, my God, I think there's a story here. So I started doing more research about the Roanoke Colony. And then I came across this this piece of research where during when the next wave of settlers came over to the New World, they stopped in Roanoke and, you know, to visit the old settlers. And that's when they discovered, like, this whole colony had just vanished. It was gone. And the only thing that was left of evidence was this carving, was this wood carving. Somebody had carved a R into the, I think it was an R, I believe it was an R. So they had, somebody had carved an R into the bark of this tree. But that was it. There was no letter. There was no, hey, we went this way, we did this. There was just an R. And from that, I started getting the idea that what if that was meant to, what if that R was left as like a warning, as was meant to start something else? And the idea was that what if the wolf, this wolfing, this one guy came back, he was a werewolf now, he wiped out the whole colony. And in order to hide his presence, you know, he burned down everything, but then he left this R, you know, which would basically point to the Roanoke Native Americans. So in the seventh issue, Hania at the time has all of his tribe, basically they get up and they leave. And he, because the idea was that he knows that more settlers are going to come. And when they come and they can't find all these previous settlers, who do you think they're going to blame? You know, they're going to blame the indigenous people that have been living there for years for killing them, you know? And so that was the idea of how Virgin Wolf essentially started. And then the more history I did, I started finding all these weird connections to different things. Like in the next arc, I'm going to deal with them going to England, and they're going to meet Shakespeare and Guy Fawkes. And it was just like, oh, all this stuff was happening all at the same time, you know, between 1605 and 1606. There's this wealth of history and knowledge about how, I guess you want to say, the New World or America starts based off actions that have happened that are occurring in the old world, you know? So that's basically how Virgin Wolf started.
Sweet.
Okay, so I guess trying to drift down, close out the whole Virgin Wolf thing. So what that got me thinking about is, when you've had something like this in your mind for like 4 to 5 years, you know, it's a question because I write a little bit too. As a comic writer, how specific do your layouts and your art hunting and everything like that become when you have something this well defined in your head, as opposed to something you're still etching out in your head and you've got an artist you like to work with? You know, how defined is everything once you start trying to put this together?
I'm not sure if it's defined enough for me, because I always tell the artist that I'm just drawing up, or I'm writing the blueprint, and you're putting the muscles and, you know, and the meat to the bone. So a lot of it is it's a collaborative effort with me, because every artist I work with, I want them to feel like, you know, they're excited about the work and that they're creating also. So I let the artists know that when I'm working with them, that, you know, here's my script, and I'm very detailed about certain things in the script. But then there are like a lot of things where I'll go, okay, an angle of, you know, the room, and she's walking into the room, so just have fun with it, you know, that type of thing. The only thing I think I was really defined about was virgin at the beginning, was that I was very adamant about, I wanted her to be this hunter, but I also didn't want to portray her as being like this super sex symbol, you know. I wanted it to be fair to that she's going to have this corset, and she's going to, of course, be looking sexy at moments. But I didn't want it to just be a book of TNA, you know, because I felt like there have been so many books that had done that. And I wanted to drift away from that, because I know that I was going to have female readers, and I didn't want my female readers to be alienated by the idea that, oh, look at this thin, sexy, tits and ass, you know, type of warrior. So I think that was the only thing where I was very adamant or about defining certain things on the page. Other than that, I was very open unless, like I said, unless there was something I was really trying to get at, which would usually be like the fight scenes. So I researched a lot of choreographed medieval fights. So I would like literally photocopy scenes of fights, or like if a character was parrying or doing some type of block, I would like photocopy those images and put them in the script and say, okay, this is the type of a fighting style that I think this character would do, or this is what I need this character to do, because sometimes it's just easier to show than try to explain. So I've been very open with Virgin Wolf and the fact of just having the artists even come in and influence, because most of the time the artists they'll come back and they'll go, hey, I had this idea for this scene. I know you wrote it this way, but I think it'll be better this way. And then I'll see the layouts and I'm like, oh my God, that's 10 times better than what I was thinking, you know?
Okay, and I don't know if this will be asking too much of a question at this point. So it seems to me like as the story goes on and the Wolfen tribe seems like this big thing, there seems to be trouble in their unity. You know, like the Wolfen in, I think, the first issue and his son sort of have it out, and you sort of see little undertones of those disagreements play out through the eight. Is that going to become a major plot point? Like, is that something we should be looking out for?
Oh yeah, with Lasang and Luke, the kindred blood is what they're called. Basically, yeah, there was there's a division in the ranks, and that was more so like of a power struggle that you would get in, you know, being in a dominant wolf pack, you know, if these were regular wolves. And so that was a play on that, but it was also a play about who really is the father of all wolfing. And, you know, and that's kind of the question that streamed through the first arc, is like, who is the father? And then once you get to that last page of issue 8, and you're like, oh, okay, now I know who the father is. Now it opens up the world, because once you realize where that character is, and again, I didn't want to hit the reader over the head. So I didn't necessarily outright say like, hey, look, he's in this place and this is where it's at, you know. But I basically put it in the terms of the Latin terms that would be used at that time to say, look, this is who this guy is and this is where he's at. So that's gonna become a bigger thing, because it's basically like you've woken up this the father, you know, you've woken up the giant, and now he's coming out into the world. So there's gonna be a lot of I guess I want to say a lot of division because of what the father wants to achieve in this, you know, this plot for world domination, and what his children or his followers start to perceive that they want to achieve, you know, whether that be throughout history or throughout, you know, just personal, you know, reasons. So yeah, that's something I think that'll play up. And the idea, I don't know if you caught on to it, that the Crimson Mask, he is the father of the Musketeer.
See, now I'm going to have to go back and reread and then look up history. So I'm somebody who likes to have to look up stuff after comics. I sort of entered comics via way of reading Marv Wolfman and Grant Morrison stories. So, like, I remember when I started, I was just always, what does this mean? What does this mean? And the fact that you're doing that for me, like, I like that.
Yeah, and again, like I said, I didn't want to hit readers over the head, but if you look at the Crimson's Mask, his costume, it is very reminiscent of the Three Musketeers, and that of, yes, the first Musketeer. And in the history of the Musketeers is that, as we know in Virgin Wolf, King Henry the Great, you know, there's that plot by Lasang and Luke to get King Henry the Great to come to Orleans, to the area of Orleans. Well, throughout history is that, basically, King Henry the Great is assassinated, and his son witnesses the assassination by a Huguenot. His son then creates the Musketeers, which become the Secret Service, or, like, you know, the guard of the king, you know? So the idea is that what you're seeing with the Crimson Mask is that he will be the father. He's the father of the Musketeer. And so there's a story in my head where the Crimson Mask goes, he basically tries to stop the assassination of King Henry the Great and fails. But in that process, Louis the 16th, I think that's his name at the time, sees him and then realizes, oh, I need guards. I need personal guards that will protect the king. And thus, the Three Musketeers are born.
Okay, so in closing on Virgin Wolf, is there like an arc length or a volume length or an issue length that you have in mind for how long this is going to play out?
I essentially wanted to do 24 issues, so I got 8 down. I got 16 more to go. But each one touches on a different... It jumps from France to England to the New World. And that's what I mean, where everything is going to come full circle. So there are events that are going to happen in England with Shakespeare and with King John the First. I think that's his name. No, one of the kings. I can't think of his name, but I think it's John. But anyway, there are events that happen in England which will reverberate into the New World. And basically, we will find ourselves at some point back at the first or the second colony, Jamestown, in the beginning of what will be the turning point of creating America.
It's pretty dope stuff right there.
That's ambitious, man.
Yeah, man, it's very ambitious.
But 24 is the goal so far.
Yeah, it's pretty dope. That's pretty dope. And I'm not as well versed in Virgin Wolf, you know, reading through it as Lou is, but I love history. And the fact that, you know, you're touching, you know, the New World, France and England is really, really, really intriguing. And it definitely has me wanting to, like, pour over everything.
Oh, dude, I think you're going to love it.
Yeah, for sure. And just seeing how the fictional world is interwoven with, you know, our actual U.S. and world history.
Yeah.
And that's sick. That's sick. You know, and the next thing that I actually wanted us to touch on a little bit more is your other piece is, you know, One Nation and just how, I don't even know the right words to say, but I'd guess it's just like how immersive and just, you know, spectacular that is. So, Lou, you want to like kick off, you know, the questions that you had regarding One Nation?
Well, first I want to start off is you're co-creating this one with Jason Reeves and you're doing this one for like 133 Art, and you know, how is that different from an idea you had when you read the words Virgin Wolf that you probably have like notebooks on stuff on to something that you're co-creating all the way through?
Yeah, well, I guess in a way it is. I guess I was going to say it's not really co-creating, but I guess it is. Jason Reeves, the artist, and he's the actual creator of One Nation. We bumped into each other some years ago at a Comic-Con. And then one day he called me up and he's like, hey, man, I got this idea I've been working on. It's called One Nation, you know. It's a book I've been drawing and I need a writer. And he's like, this is what it is. Would you be interested in looking at it and writing a story for it? And so he sent me some pages and I was just like, dude, yeah, I'll write this. And from there it became, okay, here's this Bible I have of all these ideas. And this is what I want to do with it. And Jason is a prolific writer in his own way, where he gets these ideas and he jots them down into this Bible thing. So this document he sent me, I think it had to be like 15, 16 pages long. And it just had idea upon idea upon idea about the world of One Nation and these characters and, you know, and what would be comprised of his ultimate, I guess, omnibus story. So what I did was that I basically came on to the story and rewrote the first issue because I think he was halfway through penciling it. And he was like, I don't know where the story's going or something like that. And so I came in and rewrote the first issue. And then after I rewrote the first issue, Jason was like, okay, you can prove you can write. He's like, here's the idea for the second issue. Just run with it. And I was like, are you sure? And he's like, yeah, dude. And so I wrote the second issue, which is actually coming out this year. And then it was one of those things where Jason was like, oh my God, dude. He's like, dude, you captured everything I had for this idea. And you pulled in ideas from the Bible. And I was like, yeah, that's what I was supposed to do, wasn't it? So it became this thing where when you start talking, you start thinking about how you build the story or the world, I guess I am in a way co-creating, because I'm taking all these great ideas that Jason has had and I'm helping him mold them into a story. But for that, I write everything in notebooks. So I got a One Nation notebook, and then we've done all these little spinoff stories. So every time Jason comes up with an idea for a spinoff story, I have to grab a new notebook. You know, so I write everything in a notebook. So for with that, it became more of Jason being very guarded. Then to slowly, he's like, dude, he'll just give me, like, I think the last script I did was for issue 5 or 6. It was just like a couple words. He was like, just go write it. So I was like, all right, this is the idea, you know. But I think it took some time for him to trust me to get to that point and for me to really understand all those characters, because there's so – wait till you see issue 2, dude. It's just going to blow issue 1 out the water. That's all I got
to
say.
That's spectacular to hear. That's, you know, it's always a great thing to hear, you know, each issue building upon the other one and just getting more and more impressive.
Oh, yeah, dude. Yeah, I can't, like, already issue 2 is done and coming out this year, and I'm already talking about issue 3. Like, people are like, oh, issue 2. I'm like, wait till you see issue 3, because, like, there's this big fight, and I'm like, oh, wait till you see this. And Jason's like, yeah, we cut issue 2 into issue 3, and issue 3 is going to be issue 4. And I'm like, wait, why? And he's like, wait till you see this big spread of fight scene in issue 2. I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, we can do that. So it keeps evolving, you know. Each issue keeps evolving, and you know, I'm just glad that he allowed me to play in the sandbox. You know, I'm very grateful for that.
Yeah, man, no doubt. And I guess on the using the word evolving kind of as, you know, the tagline to move on to the next part of One Nation that I actually wanted to touch on is like the world building in One Nation and how that's evolving as you and Jason become more and more in sync. You know, how has that process been?
Oh, man. I remember the first time when he gave me the first script, he was like, yeah, this story is going to be set in 92. And I was like, I don't know if I can write that. I mean, I lived it, but I was just, you know, again, it's, as a writer, you're never sure, like, if you're going to capture all the mannerisms, especially when you're doing something that's of the past. And at the time, I was still writing Virgin Wolf at the time. And so it was going between those two things. And Jason was like, no, man, you got this. And so it became this thing where it was like, are you sure, dude? I don't know if this is right. So what I did, especially for the second issue, was that I just watched a whole bunch. I remember going back and watching a whole bunch of YouTube videos because the second issue takes place during the Rodney King riots. And I just remember that happening. I had to be, what, 12 years old? Yeah, so, you know, I'm 12, so it was a profound time. But at the time, like, looking back on it, I'm like, I don't remember too much of that time, you know? So it was like going back and right, really watching a lot of videos and right, and trying to immerse myself into that time period. But also at the same time, realizing that this is still a story that has to relate today, you know, that people have to understand that what's happening in the past is going to reflect on what's happening in the present. Now, the thing that we didn't know at the time that we were writing this was that, you know, that there would be the murder of Trayvon Martin, that there would be the murder of Laquan Donald, that there would be the murder, so many different black men, because the first scene opens up with a cop harassing a young black man. And Sundiata shows up right as this cop is about to hit this kid over the head with his club. Sundiata shows up and basically grabs the club from the cop and basically checks the cops and puts them in their place. And at the time, like I said, we didn't we didn't know all this was going to go on as we were writing this. And so there's this moment where right before the riots are about to kick off, the this group called the Talented 10, they show up and they're trying to get the community to not riot. And there's this plaque that describes the 10 virtues of what this organization is. And as you're reading this plaque, it's almost like it couldn't come at a better time, because as you're reading it, it's the opposite of everything that's happening right now in this country. And you're going, oh my God, this is going to be revolutionary, because in later issues, as I've learned in working with Jason, the 10th changes the outlook of this country, because they basically come together and decide, you know what, we're going to create our own sovereign nation, you know, and that's where you get that idea of one nation that starts to come up, and how these superpowered beings kind of defy the government and defy these critics of the world and decide to do their own thing and the repercussions of that. So that's, I guess, that's how it evolved to the point now that, man, when me and Jason talk, like, I remember when we first started talking, we'd be on the phone maybe 10 minutes. Now we'd be on the phone, and before we know it, we look up and it's like 2 hours. And we're just talking about story and about characters and about, we should have this done. And every time I finish a script, we like go over it. And he's just like, dude, he always called me back. He's like, why did you do that to me? And I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, why did you have these characters in the scene? He's like, I didn't even think they could be in the scene. And he's like, I'm blown away. Now there's just one character that's going to show up later. He's like a 10-year-old kid. Man, he's a genius. And I remember when Jason wrote him, it was just like a line in the Bible about this kid. And then I ended up writing the script with this kid and talking about how he's infatuated by this one scientist. And as the story goes, you start finding out that this kid, he builds this science project. And you're thinking, oh, yeah, it's a science project. But by the end of the story, he's telling this to, like, the psychiatrist. And you find out that the project he's building is basically a weapon. And by the time the psychiatrist realizes what it is, it's too late. It's like, yeah. And the psychiatrist is, like, trying to get on the phone to call the police. And the kid is like, yeah, you remember that piece of candy I offered you at the beginning? Yeah, that's going to kill you. That type of thing.
Wow.
So it's got to the point where Jason just... I guess he just trusts me now. You know, he's like, just go off and do your thing, dude.
Sweet. That's pretty ill right there. And I got to say, one of the biggest things I got to, you know, give you and Jason mad props on, and even though it essentially came in serendipitous, it's just like how one nation is going to really be, you know, a socially conscientious, you know, type of work. And it's going to reflect society as it is now and really, you know, shine a light on the issues that are well covered, but potentially not covered as much as they should be covered.
Or in the right way.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, and that's, yeah. And that's all Jason's doing, man. That dude is, sometimes I'm like, dude, you do realize we do this, it's going to cause some trouble. And he's like, yeah, that's what it's supposed to be. And that's a lot of him just, you know, having this grand idea for a story, and I think part of it is just the more I start writing and working with these characters, the more I start to see that grand vision. And I'm just like, oh, we should do this, you know, because you have your superhero fights and stuff like that, but then those fights, like, there's meaning behind them.
Right, Lou, and I feel like that touches on something that we've talked about within the groups and everything like that, and even on other podcasts, on how, you know, how comic books should start to be seen not only as what do we call it, a genre, but like a medium where
it's a storytelling medium. You know, people think comic books, a lot of people think, you mean like Superman and Batman, and you're like, well, no, that's a genre of comic book can tell stories with, but really it's a medium, and it's one that stretches a lot of your senses at once. It's where your vision meets your eyes in a way that's a little bit different than a movie, because all the details in the pictures count, the order of dialogue count, what's spoken word and what's thought counts. And it's a really good medium, and it's great that you guys recognize that.
Oh, thank you.
Oh yeah, 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 man, yeah. It's like mad props to you. And like Alvern, like, you know, within that, with the whole with comic book being actually a storytelling medium, you know, how does that shape the you know, that idea, I would say, how does that shape the way you tackle a new subject, you know, a new story, just a new character even?
For me, it's I think I'm very weird and like from other writers, like most writers can just, you know, they jump into it. For me, I need a word. A word is all I need. But a word tells me what that story is going to be. And usually for me, when I'm writing comics, it's usually, you know, like how, you know, like you have, okay, you have the major title, you know, One Nation or Virgin Wolf, but then those secondary titles of the stories, you know, the subjects of the stories, those are usually what I use to understand what the story is. Because usually after I figure out what that word or phrase is, it opens up for me. It just opens up the whole story for me. Like I can see it from beginning to middle to end. Like, and, you know, and for me, like for instance, with Virgin Wolf, issue 2, for instance, it was called Ruse. And as soon as I knew that, I knew what the idea behind this story was, you know, the whole telling of the rules of, you know, Virgin getting away and this rules is played on the innkeeper, and then the rules that's played on the guards later and the captain of the guard later. So stuff like that. For me, that's how stories usually come to me, especially when I'm working on new stuff. Like I'm working on a book for a company called Titanium Comics. And it's based, it's a historical book. It's set in, I want to say 18th century England. And for me, I couldn't figure, like, I read all this stuff and I was like, okay, I know what the story is supposed to be, but I couldn't picture, I couldn't see the story until, I saw the title for The Old Man and the Sea, you know, the movie. And I thought, oh, I know what this story is, you know, and it was called and for me, I titled the story The Young Man in the Old World, you know, but for me, it was this telling of, you know, this idea of, for that story was that it was going to be, you know, this introduction of these new characters into this very old world, you know. So that's how I usually tackle new stories and or new ideas for stories when I'm working on projects.
That's legit. Lulu, you got anything else on One Nation?
I don't know. I just always find it, I find it interesting to hear that it's talked, just because it's like, it's always so amazing and new and different no matter who the writer is, because the writing process is so different from anybody, and it's like, all you need is a word. And it's like, you'll hear other people or you read other people talk, like Greg Weisman, Young Justice was like, I'm trying to tie everything together. And, you know, what they're doing on oh, man, I do got something to talk about, so I'll tie that in later.
Sweet.
Yeah, see, there you go. Yeah, I mean, for me, I like questions and dialogue. And I don't know if I could go off a word. And to see how much a word does for you is utterly amazing for me. But the thing I just thought of is, when you guys are working on One Nation, how are you deciding the order in which you're building this world, or like the order issues come out, like you did the issue number 1 and then you did the one shots, because it was like, why go that angle as opposed to like my favorite ongoing right now is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And you know, the one shots definitely explore Syndiata more, but what Turtles normally does is they'll keep their main line going, and then their one also be like, okay, you just saw this character do something, and now we're going to give some background on that character, you know, as opposed to One Nation. In the end of One Nation number 1, right, you just saw some out of space. And low-key, old Drew is, I didn't catch he was the same person until he showed up with the same name and some dreads and Black Lotus. Okay, so my question was on the world-building strategy in One Nation, where, you know, me as a reader, I saw the first issue with Paragon, and then I was taken to these one-offs that were pretty Syndiata centered, in Old Druids and Black Lotus. And I guess it sort of gives background to Sundiata when he acts, but is there any idea of why that was the release order as opposed to they'll drop One Nation 1 and 2, and then after Sundiata has done something pertinent into the main storyline, then, you know, you'll do your one shot there. Similar to, like, my favorite ongoing now is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And what Turtles does is, like, the early issues, they had Shredder go F some stuff up. And then it was like, want to learn more about Shredder's history? Well, catch the 2-issue Shredder miniseries. And that's sort of how they did the rest of it, as opposed to, like, ah, here's one, and here's someone else, so that when you read the next one, you're all filled in. You know, why one strategy versus the other?
Yeah, that's more Jason's call as the creator, you know, of the series. But the idea behind it, from what I understood, was that he had done One Nation 1, and he wanted the reader to understand who Sundiata is, because at the end of the first issue, you finally meet him, but you don't know who he is. And so the second issue of One Nation, of the main story, introduces Sundiata, but also introduces the 10th. So these side stories were going to be how he finds all these individuals and brings them together to create the 10th. And so the idea was that we were going to originally do the first and the second, but what ended up happening was that, as you know, there are different artists on each of the one-shots. Those end up finishing way before the second issue finished. So it was supposed to be like, here's the first issue, here's the second issue, now here's all these one-shots. But the one-shots always, they kept finishing before the second issue finished. So Jason was like, you know what, that's fine. You've met the character Sundiata in the first issue. This will give you a bit of background. So when you finally get to meet him in the regular series, which is in the second issue, you'll have a better understanding of who he is and what his abilities are, you know, from these one-shot issues. So that was how it all began. It again, happenstance. But it seems so far to work. And I guess when the second issue comes out this summer, that'll be the telling point if it indeed did work.
Dope. That's dope. Real dope.
Yeah. With Black Lotus. That was like, I think that was the first time, because we had done Old Druids. And again, that was Jason like, hey, I got an idea that I want to do for Sundiata, and I want it to be around this time period. And I was like, and once he said, again, he just told me, like, I want to do the side story. But again, it was like, I heard Old Druid, and that just gave me the idea for the story. Same with Black Lotus. Like, he's just like, I want to do a manga story, but I don't know what it should be about. And he threw me over, like, look, it has involved this character, and I want to talk about this. And then, I kept trying to figure out what the story was. And then I was doing some research, and all of a sudden the word hit me, Black Lotus. And it was like, oh, I know what this story should be, you know? So it happens like that for me.
Sweet. And matter of fact, I'm thinking about that. In a sense, it changes gears from comic books to another medium, television. And I wanted to catch on what your inspiration, what your spark was for writing out the Daredevil teleplay that you shared with us, which, you know, I read through, and it was dope. Like, it floored me. I was sucked into it like it was, you know, the actual season two premiere of Daredevil. And I was like, damn, this would be dope on TV right now.
Right? Right? That's what it should happen, right?
It's like, I was legit reading through it, and, you know, every scene and every cut and everything like that, I had the mental pictures, and, you know, with, like, Mao Ling, and when her and Matt were fighting, basically, the hand, when she fought, I was like, yo, I can see it. I could see everything. I could see their movements. I could just see their choreography. I was like, wow. It was sick.
Yeah, that fight scene was sick. That was a sick fight scene. I'm not gonna lie. I'm gonna pat my back on that one just a little. Cause like that, like the one when the nunchucko, when they come down with the 3-part nunchucko and she breaks it out, like, from the cane, and you're like, oh shit.
I really did. I was like, oh, nunchuckos, that's crazy. Or like, yeah. Or when she caught the ninja star to the eye. I was
oh,
like,
yeah, oh, I forgot about that.
Like,
yeah, and she doesn't even flinch, right? And she's
it
like,
doesn't. it really didn't faze her. And I was just like, wow, this is pretty on point with the mood and the tone of Daredevil. And you know, you said that you just really liked the TV show and you just wanted to pop off and write something like that. And like, what was the initial spark? Was it just the entire season one of Daredevil, or was it a particular scene, episode?
Yeah, I think it was. I'm a sucker for details, and one of the things that after watching the Daredevil was that they kind of left that detail about the black skies. Is that what they called?
Yeah,
the dark skies, mm-hmm. And I thought, man, that hasn't been answered, you know. And I was like, oh my god, I think I got an idea for a pilot, you know. No, I mean for a spec script. And so as I started writing it, it started. I love villains and I love characters, and so the idea that you start to see Vanessa come into her own as like the new Kingpin, I just thought that's something interesting, you know. Because there's, as you know, in the series, there's so many unanswered questions, or there's so many things that are left unanswered. Like, I was like, okay, what happened to Nobo after he dies? Like, who, do they just let that go? You know?
Yeah.
And as you see in the spec, you know, they don't let it go. They come back, and they come back with a vengeance, you know? And so the idea that I wanted to, when I wrote it, I wanted to pick up right where the show had left off, because I felt like they left it at such a great point, at a great high note, that when the second season kicks off, that first episode's got to be as great as the last one, you know. And for me, it was I really wanted to answer the question about the dark sky, but I really wanted to do something different, because I felt like the way it was set up, it was like, oh, it's going to be the traditional, you know, this kid's possessed. And so when you meet Lingua, is that her name? Again, so many characters. Mao. I'm sorry. Mao. Lingua. That you find out, like, she's the opposite of that, you know? She has the potential to be a dark sky, you know? And that's why Matt sees her in that different color, you know? And that was that whole idea that, you know, when he first meets her, like, how he's all like enchanted with her and kind of falls in love with her is because she is the opposite. So she has this potential to make him see the world in a different view. Because you remember, he sees the world as though it's burning, but with her, mm-hmm. he sees it as like this soft blue light type of thing. So it was this idea that I wanted to, you know, also explore the idea. There's the line where she touches his face, and then he's hesitant to touch her face, and she goes, yep. You know, you can touch my face. And I wanted to show, like, blind people can still be people, and that, you know, when he touches her face, it's not like he's touching her face to see who she really is, because he can already see her. It's more like, oh, you don't see me as the blind guy, you know?
Yeah. And that was dope. And I actually really loved the dialogue, the banter of everybody in there, you know, when she says, you know, when she actually has him touch her face, and she's like, I guess this is what people think blind people do. We just go around touching each other's faces. And I was like, this is spot on.
Right. Yeah. And like that scene with Foggy, and he's like, when he goes to see his girlfriend, and he like, he calls her, what do you call her?
Called her Bae.
Yeah. Yeah. And before he calls her, like, and she's like, I don't like, he calls her something licious or something, right? And he goes, and she goes, like, I don't like that nickname. And he goes, and then he kind of says it under his breath, like, I still prefer her, you know, that nickname. And I kept thinking, yeah, it's like, you can hear those characters in that script, you know? So for me, it was an exercise, I guess, or, you know, it was something that I was hoping people would notice, you know, read and stuff, but it was also an exercise to see if I could write that show. Because every time I would watch an episode, I'd be like, oh man, I would write that scene differently, or I would do this scene differently. And that, I think the scene that I think that probably really provoked me to want to write Daredevil was when the Kingpin is with Vanessa and he's looking out over the city and the bombs are going off all throughout, you know, Crime Alley, all throughout Hell's Kitchen. I thought, man, that's a pivotal moment. That shows the Kingpin it shows his ruthlessness, but also his cunning and his attention to detail, you know? So, and I thought that scene where they're watching the city burn is like the perfect villain scene. You know, you're watching the city burn, and she didn't flinch. Vanessa never flinches. She like never. Just cuddles up to the Kingpin like, yeah, you just burned half the city. Oh, okay, I'm down for that, you know? So I thought, that's interesting, you know? And then you get that scene, of course, at the beginning in the restaurant.
Absolutely. Yo, that scene in the restaurant was just legit. It really felt like Vanessa didn't miss a step. There was, you know, she didn't miss a beat from how we saw her last season and, you know, season one. And then with your teleplay, you know, the script for episode one, season two, it was just like, it felt like a natural progression, you know, her boo, he's locked up. He's waiting to, you know, go on trial. Who's going to run the business? Obviously, Vanessa, she's a boss. She is the truth. And, you know, and I think his name was Cardone. He stood no chance.
Yeah. Oh, dude. That scene, like, when she tells him, like, I'm going to send a message. And he gets up and he threatens her. And as she walks out, he's like, you still don't get it. You know, and she's like, with the message. But and she even tells him, you won't get it, but others will, you know?
Yeah, man. She was always two steps ahead of him. And, you know, and she just seems like that type of woman to really be... You know, to be of that level of sophistication, composure, and poise, and it makes perfect sense that her character would do things like that, because you know this is a woman who's caught the attention and the infatuation of Wilson Fisk. So I love that. I love how you know she's essentially the new Kingpin, and you know nothing has missed a step.
Right, and the idea that you know. They always say revenge is best served cold. So I felt like, okay, if you're going to do a next season, Matt's got to fall. Daredevil's got to fall. Who best to make him fall than Kingpin's, you know, love interest? And, you know, you can tell, like, in that, even in the spec, she goes hard. Because I had a friend when I was pitching to her the idea that her first thing was like, no, not the... the clothing guy, the costume guy. No, can't be him. You know? Yeah. And so there's a hint that, like, yeah, she's going to go that next mile. She's going to find, you know, she's going to find out who he really is. And that's what I was trying to set up in that, was that what if, you know, his whole world could come tumbling down, you know, around him. And with a person like Vanessa Fisk, who's very cunning, who's playing all the angles, who, you know, that you don't suspect. She's the kind of perfect villain for him, you know? And then at end, of course, you know, the mention, you know, Bullseye and everything. It's just like...
That was really dope. It felt like such a... And I can see the attention to detail that you take, and you know, and that's what draws you, because people who... myself, Lou, a bunch of our other, you know, members of the crew that we have, we're all like locked in on the attention to detail. And when the sniper who shot the, I can't even remember the detective's name, but the sniper who shot him, you know, once we ran through it and then, you know, I checked the internet and everything like that. And I saw that he had the Ace of Spades card. I was like, oh, that's, you know, that's a foreshadowing to Bullseye. So when you did that, I was like, nice.
Yeah, dude. So yeah, I think like I said, certain shows or certain things just get me excited. And I'm like, it becomes a challenge. Like, can I write that? I know I can write that. So I'm like, you know what? I'm gonna try to write that. I did that also for Avatar: The Last Airbender. Right. Yeah, I wrote an episode where you find out what happens to Zuko's mother, and it basically it opens up the idea that in this episode. It basically opens up for another Avatar, The Last Airbender, where Aang is like book four, you know, before they did Korra. And this is way before they did Korra, where basically you find out that Zuko's mother is living on she's living on an island that's outside of what we see on the map. And it's controlled by metalbenders. So Toph really isn't the first metalbender. And that metalbender happens to be Iroh's wife.
So... you read stuff like Avatar: The Search and go, mine was better.
Right, right. So it's one of those things where, like, you find out, like, basically, The metal benders are using capoeira, and they're black, you know, and that touches on how why Iroh, because there's this question of how did Iroh's son die, you know, and what was the reason why he died. So in the Spectre role for that, it's basically you find out that the reason Iroh's son, like the reason he dies, is because there was a war between the Fire Nation and the Metalbenders. And the only way Iroh could fix this war was that he had to trade something. And so he traded his son, but his son ends up dying and going off into the spirit world. But it basically ends the war because his son is, you know, part of the Metalbending Nation. And that's and it kind of goes into the how does the Fire Nation have all this massive technology at this time, you know? How do they have all the metal and stuff for these ships where it comes from this island where they bend metal? This is how they're able to create all these ships and stuff. So it opened up a lot, you know, and talked about the spirit realm and basically just got the whole crew back together to do it all over again.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic, man. You know, Lou and I and many of the members in our Comicidal crew basically are huge Avatar, Last Airbender fans. Also, you know, huge Korra fans. We can go on and on about both TV series, you know, and just how the societal impact that it had, the cultural impact that it had, the way that it, I mean, we grew up with these things. So, you know, that even that how it shaped and molded us in the way we think, and even how subversive it was at many times, you know, and how it didn't fit gender norms, you know. Just so many amazing adult topics that, you know, Mike and Dante didn't shy away right from. So, you know, so it's fantastic. And I mean, that's actually, it's a joy to hear, you know, hear how excited and how, just, you know, how passionate you are about these topics too. Because, you know, it kind of like shows that, hey, even professional writers out there, when they see great work, you know, it gets them charged up too.
Yeah, totally, dude, totally. You gotta be inspired by something. And you know, I just remembered I remember watching, and I always talk about this episode, it was Dwayne McDuffie. He had wrote the epilogue to Justice League, and ooh, after after that epilogue, I was just like, I was crying the first time I watched it. But then I just like, I had never met the man and had known his work at Limited, you know. But after that, I was like, I had to bow down. I literally bowed down on my knees and was like, dude, you are the man. Because for you to take all of the, I don't know if you know about the epilogue or remember it, but it's basically...
No, that's what got me into comics. So I picked up Final Crisis immediately after. Like, so Justice League ends in like 2005. Final Crisis was the DC event 2006, and I was like, ah, crap, Darkseid has the anti-life equation. What the heck does that mean? And then, like, I see a poster, and I was like, Darkseid has the anti-life equation? Let me read an actual comic book. And it was Raps.
yeah, man. And I will advocate and preach Dwayne McDuffie's awesomeness when talking about Justice League and Justice League Unlimited, you know, the cartoons, forever. Even I think he did Justice League Doom, if I'm not mistaken, the animated movie, and it was just like, it blows me away. And the fact that, you know, you speak so highly of all these other great writers and, you know, all these other great stories, and I just wanted to kind of like, you know, pick your brain even more of like, what are the other shows and books, you know, and movies that you kind of like, that basically sparked that passion for you, that gets you charged up?
Well, and this is something from my past, but it's still hands down probably one of the greatest cartoons ever done. Gargoyles by Greg Wiseman.
You know, Greg Wiseman also on Young Justice, RIP Young Justice.
That dude, I'm not going to lie, he may not know it, and I didn't know it until some years ago, but he has had a profound impact on my writing and storytelling, because there's a series that I've been... my first comic book series that I created was called Gedeon, and it was about these four kids who get these celestial powers based off this heart, based off these crystals that when combined they create this heart of Lucifer. But in that series, I talk about Arthurian myth you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff in there about King Arthur and Avalon and stuff. And then as I go back to read these scripts and look at, like, there's a character called Dragonsbane and stuff like that. And there's these Tibetan monks. As I go back to look at that stuff, I'm like, gargoyles influenced all of that, you know? I'm like, oh, wow. And even in Virgin Wolf, when I think about, like, you know, how that came to be, is the historical part, I think, oh, you know, gargoyles influenced that. Right now, I'm writing a Shakespeare comic. And it's like, oh, wait, that might have been because of that, you know? But right now, I'm following Task. You know that? Do you know that animated show that Damian Gonzalez is creating?
First time. Oh, dude,
it's hot. It's hot. Go look on YouTube. Look up TASK, Task. You know, you'll love it. He's got a trailer up right now for it. It's I'm rooting for that guy to just blow out. I don't even think the story's come out yet. I'm part of a collective, and we did a whole bunch of prose stories, and Damien wrote one on One Nation that is just phenomenal. So that should be coming out also this summer. But what else am I following? I follow weird things, and not only in TV shows. Right now, I'm loving The Flash. I think I might attempt to write a spec on that next, just because I really love Cisco. That character is just, the writers get him like perfect, you know. So
he's better than Vibe ever was in a comic book, and I've read like a decent amount of Vibe through. He's like Cisco Ramon, is it?
Yes, but every time I put on The Flash, my son just runs around the house like, I'm Flash, I'm Flash. He yells, he makes these, choo, choo, choo. And it's like so funny, you know. But I think that character means a lot to television, more than people probably realize, because he's a character of color, of Latino, and I think Mexican heritage, you know. And I think having a character on TV who's not being played like a stereotypical, oh, look, I'm good with my hands, or, you know, the X amount of jobs that, you know, they say Mexican people can do, you know, but having them being this intelligent physicist, you know, or engineer, is just like, oh, that's amazing, you know. That I think that says something more about, you know, television and the representation of diversity, more than a lot of stuff right now that's on TV, you know. And we can talk forever about diversity, so we're not even gonna get into that.
Oh yeah, we'll what I'll say, you know, and on record, we'll definitely love to have you come back for another What's Up Wednesday, and we'll get into the meat and bones of the diversity.
I want to go on record and say we invite you to Nightly T-Hawk TV, because I don't know if you had a chance to check us out yet, but that's what we do. We look for the details in this stuff and talk about this stuff. You know, The Flash is a little more lighthearted, so our details, you know, I only get a couple, but like if you get us in those Netflix series, like if you hear us talk about Jessica Jones, when we hit that Daredevil season 2, like we'll go a full hour just dissecting it. Words people said, stuff in the background. So if you want to come on and do that with us at any time, dude,
that would be kind of fun.
Yeah, it's a standard invite.
Yeah, well, thank you. Right now I'm reading a book called The Black Count. It's by Tom Rees, and basically it's the story of Alex Dumas, the real Count of Monte Cristo. And Alex Dumas was the father of the great black French writer, Alexandre Dumas, who created, as you know, the Three Musketeers, Man in the Iron Mask, the Count of Monte Cristo. But this is his story about basically, you know, he was a black general who was really fighting during the French Revolution, who was really fighting to end slavery. That's really what the story is about. And in France, and basically how his story becomes the real tale of the Count of Monte Cristo, and how he's betrayed by Napoleon because he's such a great general, you know. And so it's stuff like that. Like for me, it's that's a part of history that you never hear about, you know. Or, you know, like Cavalier de St. George, who was also a black Frenchman at the same time as Alexandre Dumas. At that time, he was considered the greatest swordsman in the world. and a better composer than Mozart.
Yo, random diversity fact. I remember, because I went to North Carolina A&T, HBCU. I did not know till my freshman year at A&T that Alexander Dumas was black.
Yeah.
And I have heard his name since, like, high school. I was tripping hard. I was like, yo, they don't tell us this stuff.
Right?
Tripping hard. Like, I learned, again, you're the same way. I learned it in college, and I came about it randomly. I think I was watching one of the movies somebody adapted, and at the end, they showed a picture of him, and I was like, wait. He's black? And so I started doing all this research, and that got me, and again, I read, when I was writing Virgin Wolf, I read Three Musketeers. So, like, every night I would go through and just read a couple pages to try to get my mindset into the idea of the type of sword fighting that was going on at the time. But, you know, that's a writer that you don't hear about. But I don't mean to go off topic. What else am I following or reading? I'm a big Michael Connelly fan. He's a crime writer. And that's what I write. I write crime novels. So I'm a big fan of his. So I try to pick up everything he ever writes. I actually have a novel coming out this summer. My first crime novel.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah, it's called Only the Holy Remain. And it's going to be coming out from Vital Narrative Press, which is a small black-owned indie publisher that is really pushing this idea that people of color, our stories really matter, you know, and that's something that I'm really behind, and I think for this publisher, I'm just grateful and thankful because there were when I was writing the manuscript, because it's about a streetwise detective. There were so many different publishers or agents that wanted me to change certain aspects of the way characters talk, and I'm like, this is how this character would talk. He wouldn't talk with proper English, or, you know, this is what goes on in this part of this neighborhood in this story. It's not all, you know, cookie cutter, you know, fairy tales or whatever. What else am I following? I guess. Anything Antoine Fuqua does, I'll follow. As a writer, anything. The Wire, of course. I'm about to get ready and watch it again. Just because it's just some great writing there. I just watched True Detective finally, and I'm just floored by that. What else am I following? It randomly, random stuff pops up. Like, I'm reading a manga called Agent, and it's about these immortals. I guess you don't read. I guess they're not immortals, but basically they can't be killed, and they have these shadow puppets, I guess. If you're an immortal, you have this type of shadow that looms over you that you can use to kill people if you know how to manipulate it. Pretty gruesome and bloody. That's published by Vertical, so I've been reading that lately, and I think the anime for that just came out. It varies, man. I'm all over the place at any given time. Right now, I'm also reading Shaft, which was written by David Walker. Something about that, like, I've never been a Shaft fan, but the way he brings that story to me, it's like, I care. You know, I didn't grow up under Shaft, so Shaft wasn't a big hero in my book, you know.
Right, okay, yeah.
But he does something great with that story. One book I'm always trying to pick up whenever I can find it or whenever it comes out is The Stuff of Legends. I love that book. It's a great comic, and so I love that. I think that's about it, I guess. I'm sure I'm watching something other than Flash right now, but I can't think of it.
You know, The Flash is a fantastic comic book TV show series right now. I think it's one of the purest ones that we've got going, where it's just like, you know, Barry's really ultimately concerned about being the best hero he can be, and they definitely pay homage to the source material really well, and they've got the campiness down perfectly.
Oh yeah, totally.
But you know, once again, we want to thank Alvin Ball for, you know, spending the time on mic with us and actually, you know, just sharing his passions and his love and just his writing process. So we definitely appreciate that, you know, from you.
See what I got coming out pretty soon. It's gonna be crazy.
Yeah. I mean, just from what you told us about with like the only the holy remain and, you know, one nation stuff, and then, you know, the continuation of Virgin Wolf, you know, I'm excited myself for sure.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, man. We just wrapped a webcomic on afropunk.com called When We Were Kings. Last chapter that dropped, I think, about 2 weeks ago. So it was 8 parts. Each part is, I think, between 5 and 6 pages. So I just finished that up. So if you get a chance, check that out. I think you'll love that. It's basically a story about a astronaut who returns to Earth only to find that it's been decimated by a nuclear war. And now he's searching for his family through this wasteland.
Wow, sweet, 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 sweet. So, you know, as we wrap this up, I want to say once again, thanks to Alvin Wolf for, you know, being on mic with us. Everybody, check out One Nation. Check out Virgin Wolf. Be on the lookout for Only the Holy Remain. And then give us the plug for the webcomic again, Alvin.
Yeah, it's called When We Were Kings. It's published by Afropunk.com. We're up for a couple of nominations of... I'm hoping we get nominated for a few awards. So, but I can't say yet until it's official. But I'm praying that we get nominated. At least for a glyph or something.
All right, nice.
Yeah, I think that's it. I'll be hitting you guys as more stuff comes out. Cause like I said, I'm working on a manga that I'm developing called Kaiten Shinpo 5, and then I have another manga webcomic that's coming out called Jukebox Legends with artist Chris Bayless. That'll be coming out, I think, around May or June of this year.
Sweet. Swag, swag, swag. We'll keep our ears plugged for that, and we'll definitely, you know, pub it through our Twitter profile and everything like that. So, as always, Comicidal fanboys and fangirls, you can find us on Twitter at Comicidal T-Hawks. Send us letters, ComicidalT-Hawks@gmail.com. I'm RP Wilson again with Lucius Illuminix. And, you know, many, many thanks to our very first What's Up Wednesday guest, Alvern Ball. We hope to hear more from him and have him on mic with us again in the future.
Thank you guys for having me.
And that's all we've got tonight, y'all. Peace.